You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, Nick.
Hey, what's up, Alex?
Hey, we're back for part two.
We are back.
We're back for part two. Before we dive in.
Yeah.
Before we dive into stage to screen play.
Yes.
Question for you. So you're coming out to LA soon.
I will be out on the West Coast. That is correct.
You will be out on the West Coast to be with your wife who's attending school in San Diego.
Yes.
Now, you are aware.
Yeah.
That San Diego is about 2 hours away from Los Angeles, correct?
Where are you going with this, buddy?
You do know. Now, you're coming from New York, where if you want to get from A to B,
yeah.
You have a subway.
Yeah.
You have a taxi cab.
Yeah.
Everything is about 45 minutes to get anywhere you want to go. You are aware that to get from San Diego to Los Angeles, you will have to drive a car.
No.
And I seem to remember that you don't know how.
I don't.
Ooh, he's sensitive.
No. There's no sensitivity here, Alex. Here's what I want to say to you. Yeah, I will have to drive at some point. And I do want to learn how to drive. I do want to get like, and granted, here's what I'll also say. I do know how to drive. I don't have a license. I never got a license, but I do know how to drive. So I will make that distinction. But I want to say this. The first thing that I will do when I come to your coast is learn how to drive, assuming that it is safe for me to learn how to drive with this pandemic raging. That said, you also have the Pacific Coast Surfliner up the coast.
I knew you were that. Trust me, that is not an option.
That is like a
fun diversionary taking the train up the coast.
I love
if you
that
had to
train.
Be in LA for an audition or something, or to come see your best friend. Taking the Surfliner is such an expensive, like, time consuming thing to do.
Hey guys, listen up. I'm on Cameo. Okay, I'm on Broadway Plus. Come at me. Let's make some money together so I can take the Surfliner up the coast.
Oh man, we're so broke.
Little justice.
Welcome to Little Justice, Little Justice, the broke podcast, Broke by Broke. We ain't got
I
it.
I will. I'm keeping that one in my pocket, the Cameo thing in my pocket, because that I can pay you $30 and you
$45, sir.
$45? Oh, you upped your rate. Make you say whatever I want.
I can turn it down. I can decline to do it.
Yeah, but you wouldn't do that. Not to me.
If you were paying me to do it, then no, I would not turn you down.
Yeah, you'd do anything for $45.
No, I'd do anything for your $45.
That's
you
fair.
Specifically.
That's like 20% of everything that I've got.
Mm-hmm.
More
listen,
or less.
Dude. Listen, the pandemic, it's so crazy. We're doing on the podcast that shall not be named to the day of this.
Oh my
recording.
God, you can name it. You keep calling it the podcast that shall not be named, but I don't care.
Well, it's the Chaos Twins, and we're a talk show. We're not a podcast, we're a talk show. But
yeah,
on that,
there you go. You're a talk show.
We're a talk show, but
I know that we're better than that. We should bring we should bring Sasha on, because I've never met her.
She actually would love to come on. We've been talking about this. Yeah. We will bring Sasha on.
Brand synergy.
Yeah, get the brands together. Get them together. Get them bouncing off each other. And then you can come on the
Chaos
Twins.
You don't have
Twins.
To like tiptoe around it, the show that will not be named. Like, it's not Voldemort.
Or is it?
Or is it?
But no, we're going to do an episode, actually, the day of this recording, on financial advice and stuff of that nature. And it's just so funny because, this pandemic, man, it takes your money.
It definitely takes your money. It does not replenish your money. Yeah, I'm in the midst I started getting into real estate investment last year. And so I am managing rental properties in upstate New York, which has been a challenge in and of itself. But it's an especially interesting time to be doing that, where like people just renting has become different. The expectations of things and rent price, it's been a real adventure. It started crazy and then COVID happened. And now
adventures in babysitting, dude. It's real. But we are back with part two of our stage to screen adaptations. Our favorite stage to screen adaptations. The stage play is this one, this episode. And we are very excited. I actually love I love stage plays that have been turned into movies because there are so many that we actually don't think about. There's so many movies that come from plays.
There are a lot.
There's a ton. And there's the movies that are publicized that they came from a play. And then there's the movies that aren't. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think when Closer came out, I don't think that was ever publicized.
Closer was a play?
That's exactly what I mean. Yeah, Closer was a play. Patrick Marber. Wow. Yeah, it's an amazing play and makes an amazing movie. You know, but like people never, you know, when it's a musical, it's a little harder to hide. But with a good play,
right.
Like for instance, Leslie Odom, the guy who, you know, essentially gave me a job, is doing a, do you remember that play that I did in Denver? One Night in Miami.
One Night in Miami. Yeah, I love that. That was my favorite show you've done.
It's my favorite show I've done. He's in the movie version of that is being, that
oh,
was, did just got, cool. just got directed by Regina King for HBO.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's going to be good.
It's going to be amazing. It's going to be amazing.
I love too when you watch something and you can tell, like, you know what, this was probably a play, or when you watch something and you have that thought and then you find out that it wasn't.
And I think that speaks to the writer, right? I think that you know, it all comes down to,
and usually that it's a playwright.
Yeah, who exactly.
Wrote a movie. Like what's his name, who did In Bruges and Three Billboards?
Oh, Martin McDonagh. Yeah,
Martin McDonagh, who's like, okay, this guy's definitely a playwright, even though he hasn't staged these.
Yeah.
Scripts that he's written, it's a definite playwright that
wrote
it.
It's a play. But I think that what that comes back to is just a love of language. And I think that I think that's something that a lot of screenwriters discount, right? Because again, film is a visual medium, so you want to go to the visual first. But we sometimes can get bogged down in the fact that like good dialogue can take care of so much of, you know, of a film. And it doesn't have to be overly used dialogue, but just like solid, good dialogue. Like I think about The Wire, which is not a film, right? But The Wire was famously,
to say that you think about The Wire is the understatement of my life.
I think about The Wire.
You don't
so
think
often.
About anything but The Wire.
I really do. I really love The Wire so much because it's the best piece of writing on TV, I think, in the past 10 years, 15.
I'm gonna try again. I have a confession, is that I've never made it past late second season of The Wire.
You gotta keep going. If you're looking, if you need more action in your TV show, not the show for you. Like, if it really is not the show where you sit back and you're entertained, it is the show that if you watch even three episodes in, four episodes in, there are payoffs because it is all callbacks. It is all prophecies coming true. Things that were subtly set up that all of a sudden blossom. But none of it is hitting you over the head. It is very much like the slowest of slow burns. But like once you get revved into it, like you by the third season, you're just cooking with gas because it's like now we're going back to things that happened in one and two, and you know it's freaking beautiful. But all that to say, the dialogue is probably my favorite thing about The Wire, and that dialogue was all written by.
I mean, I assume that's why you love The West Wing also.
That is exactly why I love The West Wing. I love Sorkin. I love David Simon. I love David Milch, who wrote Deadwood. Anyone who can just do things with words. I just think that we get so afraid sometimes of using words in film. And I think that words are powerful always, always.
Well, there's that old adage, some, I don't know, show don't tell.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
And so you get, and they certainly teach you this in film school. And the whole thing is like, if you don't need to use words, then don't use words. And I think that can be true in many situations, but I think that there is also an art form to the song and dance of conversation.
Yeah.
Or even monologue, which is just conversation with the self. Right.
Exactly.
And even if it's flowered up, even if it's not realistic, if it's not how someone would actually speak, there's a real, you know, art form to appreciate in that.
And I want to push up against this because, again, I think even if you're going for quote unquote realism, none of this is how someone would actually
speak.
Oh, no.
Do
you know what I mean? Like we are giving you, you know, when you are writing a script, play script, movie script, whatever, you are giving us the best hits, right? You are literally going through and like the thing that would take the normal person 5, 6, 7 tries to get right, you are putting it down on the page as their number one.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So there's nothing natural about this. So I always, whenever I hear that concession, I'm like, throw that out the window. Do you know what I mean? Like, we are talking about a heightened reality no matter what your story is. And the only choice that you have is, are you going to be blatant about that heightened reality or not? I think that's what I hear when I hear realism or not. And I think that, you know, if we're talking about these writers, I think that the way that dialogue can be a misdirection, it can be show, don't tell, because I think that good dialogue, you know, you can learn something about the characters and they can talk about things that have nothing to do with plot. Again, going to go back to my boy. Who's my boy? Who's my boy, Alex? Tarantino. Tarantino. Some of his best dialogues are when you have characters, he drops you in the middle of a scene and the characters are talking about things that ostensibly have nothing to do with the movie, that are just like their favorite song on the radio or this meal that they had the other day, or you mean just these random things, but that teach you about character without telling you character.
Yeah. I got a really good note on a script a long time ago. It was early on. I hadn't written much. And the note was that the dialogue I was writing, you know, the characters are saying too directly what they're feeling.
Yeah.
Like, people don't talk like that. Real people, they lie, they misdirect, they talk about other stuff, they deflect. Real good dialogue doesn't actually say what it's saying
at all.
Right. There's something else that then the actors can take and work with it and bring it to a new level when they perform it. And there's whole depths to simple words.
Well, and think about it this way. It's like, again, you want to talk about show, don't tell. If you allow the characters to pull you in, it comes down to, can I hear you writing this? Or is this the character speaking? Is this Alex speaking or the character? Alex, the writer, wants you to know that Johnny feels sad today, right? So he says, I feel sad. And that's Johnny's line. But how would Johnny do that? Johnny would come into the kitchen and maybe he makes himself some toast, but like maybe the toaster's broken, so he has to hit it one or two times. Maybe his wife's looking at him a little weird. You mean like there's so many ways to say that. And then in his dialogue, maybe his dialogue is terse. Maybe he's like, you know, speaking in like three word sentences that day. He doesn't really want to talk to somebody that day. That tells you that Johnny is sad without ever saying, I am sad today.
Yep.
You know, even going back to Shakespeare, you know, thinking of a sad character, Antonio in The Merchant of Venice, his first line is, in sooth, I know not why I am so sad. He doesn't say I am sad. The first thing he says is, I don't know why I'm sad. So already he's made it active. Already we're not worried about the actual emotion. He's on a pursuit to find out why. So even that is misdirection. And I think it's all just applicable to writing, you know, to writing 101, you know, just show, don't tell. But I think you can do that with words. And I love stories and plays, on especially stage to screen, that do that. So yeah, man, do you want to go first? Because I feel like this is one where we probably didn't choose the same one.
The chances are a lot slimmer, especially because you kind of just have a broader knowledge of
sure.
these things.
Sure.
I couldn't think of a ton, because my mind does immediately go to like Martin McDonagh, to things that are play-like, but maybe not even from stage, and things I definitely haven't seen. But there is one film that stuck with me since I saw it when it came out. And I knew when I saw it, it was based on a play, and I would love to see it staged. Yep. And so to me, and honestly, it relates to last week's topic of musicals and what makes an effective musical. Something very, very important to me is clarity of tone and clarity of theme more than tone. I want to know from the get-go, what is this about?
Yep.
And then I want to see a master crafting a story that sticks to that theme and explores that theme with clarity and presence and power, so that you can, you know, there is nothing wasted. Every scene, every character, every interaction is saying something. Even the name of this show is the theme, and it starts off exploring it and it doesn't stop the whole time.
Oh, good for you. I love that. Great pick.
So we open in 1960s Bronx. This is New York. It's an early morning. A boy is getting ready to go to school. He gets up. He goes out, passes people on the street. He goes to a Catholic school, and they have morning. You know, he's an altar boy. He gets ready, meets his friend, who's also an altar boy. You go through the sermon. The father gets up, and he asks, "What is doubt?"
That's the topic of my sermon today. Last year, when President Kennedy was assassinated, who among us did not experience the most profound disorientation? Despair. Which way? What now? It was a time of people sitting together, bound together by a common feeling of hopelessness. But think of that. Your bond with your fellow being was your despair. It was a public experience. It was awful. But we were in it together. Doubt can be a bond as powerful and sustaining as certainty. When you are lost, you are not alone.
Ugh. Ugh. This movie. I could speak for the film.
I mean, this is, even knowing nothing about the staged version of it, even knowing it felt to me, you could word for word, you could take this movie and put it on a stage, which I assume it's probably not far off.
It's pretty close.
It's pretty close. But the translation, the actual filmmaking, and Roger Deakins shot it.
Yep.
I don't know if you...
It's
beautiful to look at. It's articulate. The cinematography is articulate. And the blocking and the performances. And it's basically about a Catholic school where the head nun, who's this real, you know, sharp... She's like, almost like a stereotype of what you assume.
Yep.
The head nun at a school like this to be. She's really strict with the kids. She's very, you know, she's just poisonous with everybody. Always, you know, wrinkling up her nose at every single thing. She gets it in her head that there might be something with the priest and one of the boys. Never any distinct evidence of it. You know, there's never anything direct. She just, it's about the seed that gets planted. And how far can you take that before you, you know, ethically, morally, whatever, can't pursue it anymore? And it's Meryl Streep versus Philip Seymour Hoffman, which is, you know,
it's like watching two Titans. Like, and then you also have Amy Adams, who's always incredible, and freaking Viola Davis coming in and like saying, "Hey, world, here I am. I'm ready to be a star now." And at that point had been in the theater game for years. But this was a role that came
crashing through the door.
Oh my God. Yeah.
And it's one of those things. I remember watching, there's one scene in particular, and I may just cut it in its entirety.
Yep.
Because I've watched it on YouTube probably 30 times because of just how precise it is dramatically. Yeah. It uses visual metaphor. It uses everything it has to, God, I don't even know how to describe it. It for the same reason that I love There Will Be Blood in terms of how it handles greed.
Yeah.
Right? Where in every single scene, if you take the word greed and you slap it up on the screen and watch the scene that's playing out, the scene is about that. Yes. Right? You will be able to find the concept of doubt in every single scene of this movie.
Yes.
And it's about how people lie. It's about how people get these thoughts in their head that they maybe don't want to have or know they shouldn't have. It's about dealing with simplicity versus complexity. It's about so many things. And the whole film becomes this playground for drama.
Matt, come in.
A third party would be required.
Yeah, what was Donald's mother doing here?
We were having a chat.
About what?
A third party would truly be required.
No, sister, no third party. Me and you are due for a talk. You have to stop this campaign against me.
You can stop it at any time.
How?
Confess and resolve.
You are attempting to destroy my reputation.
You keep opening my window. What are you doing in this school?
I'm trying to do good.
Even more to the point, what are you doing in the priesthood?
You are single-handedly holding this school and this parish back.
From what?
Progressive education and a welcoming church.
You can't distract me, Father. This is not about my behavior.
No,
it's about
yours. This is about your unfounded suspicions.
That's right. I
just
have
just leave
suspicions.
That. It's not important.
I will decide. What's important?
You know, funny story. So Sarah Moonstruck is one of Sarah's favorite films,
which was written by John, and directed, or
no, not directed, written.
Not directed, but certainly directed by Norman Jewison, but written by John Patrick Shanley,
for which he won an Oscar. I think
he did. In fact, they screened Moonstruck at the Museum of the Moving Image, and then there was a talk with John Patrick Shanley afterwards. Now, I have never seen John Patrick Shanley in person. I've seen so many of his plays. You know, I doubt, obviously, Danny and the Deep Blue Sea, really, especially like when you're studying theater, like mm-hmm. you get thrown a lot of John Patrick Shanley. You get thrown a lot of John Patrick Shanley. And you watch this movie, which is like so New York and so like specific New York. And like he has this kind of Italian American, Irish American dialect down, right? Like these worlds are just like, boom, there for you. And then the movie ends, and he's sitting there, and they ask him a question. He opens his mouth to speak. If this man does not sound like every character that you just heard on the film, and it was like, I mean, he literally sounds like Nicolas Cage in Moonstruck. That is who he is. And it was fascinating because, like, oh, it's like the write what you know, and it's not about, you know, him knowing, you know, what it's like to be a man who, you know, makes bread in a basement and has his hand cut off and, you know, starts an illicit affair with Cher. But like, he writes about his world, and Doubt is a perfect example of that, where, you know, the Catholic school, and that he talked about that in his talk back, all these larger than life characters and dealing with this thing. He also, I love Doubt because Doubt deals with, in a way that very few writers who aren't Black can deal with, he dealt with what it's like to be a token in such a, and she only has one scene, like it really is just that one scene for Viola Davis, but like, the, you know, she is the mother of the son who is suspected of being victim to this illicit relationship with Philip Seymour Hoffman, and Meryl Streep's character comes to her and says, you know, what do you want us to do about this, how do you want us to proceed, you know, we need to get him, we need to get him away from your son. And she's like,
sister, you ain't going against no man in a robe and wind. He's got the position
and he's got your son.
Let him have him then.
What?
It's just till June.
Do you know what you're saying?
No more about it than you.
I believe this man is creating, or may have already brought about, an improper relationship with your son.
I don't know.
I know. I am right.
Why you gotta know something like that for sure when you don't?
What kind of mother are you?
I mean, number one, there's a sense that she knows that he is different. And by different, you know, like that she knows that he is probably gay. And he's also a Black student, mm-hmm. and his father doesn't understand, you know, him and this school. If she's like, if you're telling me that he has to choose between a father who's going to beat him and this school where this man has taken a shine to him, and, you know, whatever the nature of their relationship, can be a safe space for him.
That's why his father beat him. Not the wine.
What are you telling me?
I'm talking about the boy's nature now. Not anything he's done.
Which is such an amazing conversation to have.
Oh my God. Like
it's such a heavy
conversation.
Conversation.
And had so quietly, too. It's never explicitly said.
Never explicitly said. And I think it's elevated by that point, right? Because there is a reason that Philip Seymour Hoffman's character cannot, there's obviously something that he's hiding.
Yeah.
And I think the analysis of the film that I buy the most is that his character is gay.
Yep.
And can't do anything about it. That's what makes sense through his manner. He's obsessed with clean fingernails. He's like, where's my fingernails long, but they're clean. Look how clean they are.
Yeah.
It's about keeping order in your house, which is exactly what Meryl Streep is about.
Yep.
And the confusion that sets in when people cannot be open with each other.
Yep.
When people have only, you know, they're rigidly confined by society, whether it's race or sexuality or religion or anything. They're put in these confinements. And because of that, they have to hide things about themselves that then cause other people to distrust them.
Yep.
And that's where doubt comes from, is not knowing who someone else is and suspecting that there's something going on that might need attention.
Yeah, really, it really is just a beautiful exploration of that theme, and takes you down the rabbit hole. And again, can't speak enough about Meryl Streep. You know, I look at young Denzel and you see just an incredible work with him. But in terms of somebody who has sustained and only gotten better, mm-hmm. as they've gotten older, Meryl Streep is it. I'm sorry. Daniel Day-Lewis, like, you can say Daniel Day, but Daniel Day is incredible. But he also, I think that Daniel Day kind of, like, not that there's a cheat to Daniel Day, but I love Daniel Day. But Daniel Day makes a movie every 10 years. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, he has time
to
sit.
It's a whole different thing. Meryl Streep is a master of her craft.
Yeah.
You know, Daniel Day is almost a freak. he's just like, he pops in when he wants to and he does an amazing job and then he leaves. He's not concerned about finding the next great thing and beating it to death and creating something out. Like, Meryl Streep will finish a movie and she'll go straight on stage, and she'll finish a play and she'll go straight back to movies. And she's like, she just loves working.
And that's the thing. Like, and you see her, I'm sorry, I've never seen a Meryl Streep performance that I didn't like. I saw Mamma Mia because Meryl Streep was in it.
And
she was
like, great.
She was great. She was fun. She was having fun. Like, it's just somebody who truly, clearly enjoys what they do.
Yeah.
And loves that play of what they do. And, you know, from somebody who started as like this small supporting character in Deer Hunter to where she is now.
Right.
It's just like, I mean, and before Deer Hunter, she was doing New York theater for years. And
yeah,
it's just like, wow.
It was interesting to me. I was very excited when the film version of August Osage County was coming out.
Yeah.
Because the stage version was so phenomenal and it's Meryl Streep and it's all this stuff. I was a little disappointed by that.
I heard that one didn't come out so great.
It didn't. And I think that that can be a problem with translating stage to screen, is like, if you're not doing anything new with it, if you're not using the tools at your disposal to maximize everything, then you're doing it wrong, right? You can't just assume it's going to work. I watched a movie recently, I can't even remember what it is, and the reaction I had was, that was pretty good, but you could have anybody direct that and it would look the same way.
Yes.
Right, this could have been, it was like somebody took a good script and they just did the work, and then it came out the other end with no voice, with no flavor, with no style, with no, you know, deeper anything like that. I think Doubt seems like a movie, and again, I haven't seen the stage version, but it seems like a movie where they really dug into what it was about, and they cared very, very much about creating the world and creating the characters and being real, and knowing the limitations of the screen too.
Remind me, do you ever leave the church in Doubt? You're pretty much always on the grounds.
Pretty much, or outside the grounds. I mean, the film starts in, you know, the kid's house and walking down the street, and you get within the periphery, but most of it, takes place in or around.
Yeah. Yeah. So, it really,
it's amazing. So,
Doubt.
You haven't the slightest proof of anything,
but I have my certainty. And armed with that, I'll go to your last parish and the one before that. If necessary, I'll find a parent. Trust me, Father Flynn, I will.
You have no right to act on your own. You have taken vows, obedience being one. You answer to us. You have no right to step outside the church.
I will step outside the church. If that's what needs to be done, though the door should shut behind me, I will do what needs to be done. Though I'm damned to hell. You should understand that, or you will mistake me.
Doubt. I don't doubt that you will love this movie.
I don't doubt it.
I don't doubt it. Go watch it.
And R.I.P. Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Let me tell you, loss. That's another one who I think is, I mean, and I, you know, all the way back to Twister, when he was playing Dusty, the crazy storm, like,
love
just
that.
Somebody who just clearly loved the work, and I, everything, he was one of those actors when he died that my mom called me up and she's like, I know he meant something to you. And like, it was, his work was just always everything that I wanted to do. I just thought he was just magnificent.
I mean, someone else who pays attention, who's there to get dirty. There to like get really do the work, do the job. Yeah. The only time I ever saw him in person was at school in New York, because he lived around NYU.
Yeah, he lived right there.
And he would just walk around the streets. He was in sweatpants. It was like November. And he would his hair's going in 18 different directions. He's just big, you know, baggy shirt and these sweatpants and sneakers, looking like a homeless person, probably just going to work.
Yeah, just chilling. I got a chance to, well, I actually didn't get to see it. Oh my God. But I wanted to see. He did a production of Othello at Skirball, at NYU Skirball. It was him and John Ortiz as part of, I think it was part of the Labyrinth Theater Company. And I would have killed to see him as Iago. Jeez. I feel like his Iago would have been just stellar. Yeah. Philly sees, we love you and thank you for everything you left us. You know, you're incredible. But yeah, man.
And another Philip Seymour Hoffman film dealing with theme is The Master, which if you haven't, because that's another very poignant, where you can tell he knows what that movie's about and he's doing everything he can to get it out.
Yeah, it really, he incredible. Is, again, just a gift of an actor, and just anything you watch him and Capote, you know, I know everybody loves Capote, and but Capote. That is truly the tip of the iceberg for Philip Seymour Hoffman. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to take a quick advertisement break to pay for things. But when we come back, we will have some money choices for you. We will be right back after these messages.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Okay. So my movie that started as a play is definitely different than Doubt. But also, when you're talking about a movie that zeroes in on a theme and then just goes for that theme, this movie certainly does that. Doesn't put the theme in the title, but from the very opening, you understand what this movie is. Watching it, you know, I'll say this. So the first way that I was going to go with this was Amadeus. And we will talk about, I will bring Amadeus into this at some point in the future, because I will look for it. I love Amadeus. I also love Amadeus because, funny fact. So Tom Hulse, who plays Amadeus, is the lead producer on Ain't Too Proud on Broadway.
Oh, no way.
So whenever, and I haven't even told him this yet, but like, so like my, you know, when this, like we talked about, Ain't Too Proud was my first, you know, my first big lead on Broadway, and I cannot wait to go back at some point. But you know, your first 2 weeks leading a Broadway show, especially when you're coming in as a replacement, are insane, because everybody is trying to get used to you, right? The whole building has functioned around how a certain person's rhythm has gone, and now that rhythm has changed, and they're all trying to figure out, okay, what's your rhythm? And because you are the number one, it all goes from the top down. So I'm getting, you know, literally at every half hour, I'm getting sound techs in there saying, can you do this a little louder? Can you do this a little quieter? I'm getting, you know, hair and makeup people in there like asking me how I want my makeup today, or how I want my hair today, or whatever. And then for about 3 weeks straight, I would have Tom Hulse come into my room and just sit down and like he, Tom Hulse and Ira Pittleman, who are the producers, and I'm not just saying this because it's the show that will employ me when this pandemic is over. They are two of the best producers on Broadway. I have yet to look that man in the face and be like, sir, I need you to know that your performance changed my life. I have not said that to him. And I don't just mean Amadeus. I also mean the Hunchback and Hunchback of Notre Dame. I'm like, I just, every time I look at him, like, I just see his little, his face and I'm like, oh my God, you were Amadeus. And I was
playing at
that.
The party and the, that oh. whole improvisation scene getting chased around by the girl. Yeah.
Oh my God. He's so, he was, oh my God. He's
iconic.
So, iconic. And such, and such a hard part, right? Because you have to play this asshole, but also he's a genius, but also you have to care about him. And he thread that needle so well. And I,
amazing.
I just,
I had
it.
No idea.
Yeah, me. I mean, yeah, and I've loved him for a long time. So it was originally gonna be Amadeus, and then I was like, no, we can do a little better than that. We can get some deep cuts. So I chose a movie that is a movie. Again, I think with both Sweeney and this, these are both pieces that I will kill to do. People always ask you when you're a theater actor, like, what roles do you want to play? And I always, it's so funny because I always say this title to, you know, kids who mainly study musical theater, and they're like, what is that? I'm like, well, you need to learn what this is because it is one of the best plays ever written. We open with some super 80s looking title cards, like black titles again with like a blue glow behind them, and like they kind of like ripple as like a like there's like a train passing by. We open up on a city, you know, and we open up on a phone booth. And an old man is sitting in a phone booth, trying to, like, he's talking. He's just talking real fast. We don't know if he's trying to sell something, if he's trying whatever. And there's just a look of just forlornment on his face. And then Ed Harris gets into the phone booth next to him, and he's selling some things. And then they're like, "Are you going to the meeting? What meeting?" They have a whole conversation about the meeting. And we show up at the back of their office, and there's a stacked cast. Jack Lemmon is the old man. We have, like I said, Ed Harris. We have Kevin Spacey before we knew Kevin Spacey's past. We have, I was about to say Alan Alda, but it's on the hook. Oh my God. Why am I forgetting
Alec Baldwin?
No, well, Alec Baldwin is there. He's pacing. But the actor that I'm talking about is, of course, Alan Arkin.
Alan Arkin.
The people in that room are Jack Lemmon, Alec Baldwin, Ed Harris, Alan Arkin, Kevin Spacey. And Alec Baldwin is pacing. He's like, are they all here? Because I'm going to go. And they're waiting on one more. He's like, no, I'm going anyway. And he rips into this speech about how these guys are pathetic. And how they need to always be closing. And that is, of course,
holy.
Glengarry Glen Ross.
Let me have your attention for a moment. Because you're talking about what? You're talking about bitching about that sale you shot. Some son of a bitch don't want to buy land. Somebody don't want what you're selling. Some broad you're trying to screw, so forth. Let's talk about something important. Are they all here?
All but one.
Well, I'm going anyway. Let's talk about something important. Put that coffee down. Coffee's for closers only. You think I'm fucking with you? I am not fucking with you.
This movie is heartbreaking in a way that I had forgotten. I had forgotten how messed up this movie is. And I love, so a lot of people don't like Mamet as a writer. I love Mamet. People think that his writing is too robotic. He very much writes for rhythm, and he writes it, you know, his theory, or, you know, he's very famous for what his theory is purported to be, which is like, just say my words and they will work. Don't act these things. Just say the words. And truthfully, if you just say the words, they will work. The words are powerful, and he uses a lot of repetition, and he uses a lot of like broken sentences. Characters do not use pronouns often. They just jump right in the middle of the line. And it's all to give you a sense of quickness, right? He's writing about dirty, dirty, dirty people.
That watch costs more than your car. I made $970,000 last year. How much you make? You see, pal, that's who I am, and you're nothing.
People who are like on the grimy side of life. And Glengarry Glen Ross is no exception. And, you know, this kind of race to the finish for these salesmen to sell these leads, kind of like a precursor to The Wire, because they're just, it's such an impossible task that one of them comes up with the idea to steal the good leads, right? Because the leads that they have to sell these properties are bunk, are terrible. So like, well, I'll just go in there and steal the good leads. And then the second half of the movie is like, after the leads have been, you know, the place was ransacked and somebody tried to steal the leads, the, you know, the kind of interrogation that happens.
It's a big decision, George. Times a guy's got to make one. And it's a big decision and it's a big reward. $2,500 and a job, it's a big reward for one night's work.
Yes.
You know, sometimes a guy...
Sometimes a man, if he wants a reward...
That's absolutely right.
But it is truly just like a playground for these actors to go to town. And it really is heartbreaking because you just see what just like the American ideal yet again does to the psyche. You know, these guys are broken down. They are truly broken and they are racing and they are trying anything they can to get these leads, you know, and the famously, the Alec Baldwin opening monologue is actually not in the play. You never
really?
See Alec. Yeah, yeah, it's not in the play. It was subsequently added to the play after the movie. But like even then, like a lot of productions that I've seen still don't use it. But it is so necessary.
Interesting. Yeah, because I figured that's like the whole point.
It sets up the stakes perfectly. Perfectly. Yeah. The play opens with Jack Lemmon's character Shelley. And Williamson, Kevin Spacey's character, in a booth in a Chinese restaurant, like, and Shelley's trying to convince Williamson to give him the good leads,
right?
And Williamson's like, no. And it's just the dialogue in that scene, like the dialogue in all these scenes. I mean, it's just heartbreaking. It's just crazy.
Shelley.
Yeah.
You ready to do or die tonight?
Oh yeah. Always ready, John. Now, one thing. We were talking about the leads. I understand we got some new ones.
Yeah, that's what we're going to talk about at the meeting.
Here we are. Because I'm running into a little bit of a snag.
Yes, I've seen your sales figures.
That's the leads, John. You give me a better lead.
That's what we're going to be talking about tonight.
Personal bind. You understand? Personal problems. I could use a leg up.
After the meeting.
I hear the new Glengarry leads.
After the meeting, Shell.
Well, so in terms of the translation from stage to screen, what do you think... Besides Alec Baldwin's monologue, what do you think the movie did that enhanced or brought out differently the story?
Oh, gave it more locations. You know, you're able to see more of the space. So the play literally just takes place. Act one is three scenes in the same Chinese restaurant. Act two is the office after it's been ransacked. That's it. The movie allows you to see the street outside the Chinese restaurant. The train overhead, you just get a sense of the world for these guys. It allows you to make home visits, right? Jack Lemmon goes to somebody's home and is like, let me try to sell you on this. So you're able to see them in action. So there's just a little more fleshed out. Like you end up, I think, honestly, you end up caring about these characters a lot more than you do in the play. Because in the play, they're kind of just like these fast talking assholes. And in the movie, you really get there's a little more breath. And you get the time. And I really, again, I'm going to go back to Jack Lemmon because his performance in this movie is, I mean, it's pretty spectacular. It's, you know, Al Pacino gets the accolades and he got the Academy Award nomination for this. But let's not sleep on Jack Lemmon. The character of Shelley, who actually Al Pacino ended up playing in the most recent revival, is really like the kind of the Willie Loman of this group. Like he is just the person who, if the play is about the American dream and what the American dream does to people, Shelley Levine is at the end of his American dream and he is fighting with his last breath to hold on to any semblance of it. And Jack Lemmon imbues him with such, you know, because, and especially because it's Jack Lemmon. So already we're walking in, you know, having our memories of this guy as just like a, you know, just like a good old, you know, good TV comedy. We love his work guy.
Yeah.
And to see him so broken and to see him trying to keep that facade up is just, oh, your heart goes out. And when he's finally revealed, spoiler alert, when he's finally revealed as the guy who did over the office, the descent for him is so heartbreaking. It's at this moment where he thinks he's got, Kevin Spacey's character beat. And then he says, he gets too cocky and he says one wrong thing that lets Kevin Spacey know, oh, you're the guy that bumped off The Office.
You are so full of shit.
You robbed The Office.
Oh, sure. I robbed The Office. Oh, sure.
You asshole. What did you do with the leads?
You want to go in there?
I tell him what I know. He's going to dig up something. You got an alibi last night, Shelley?
You better have one. What did you do with the leads? If you tell me what you did with the leads, we can talk.
Yeah, well, I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
If you tell me where the leads are, I won't turn you in. If you don't, I'm going to tell the cop you stole them. Mitch and Murray will see that you go to jail. Oh. Believe me, they will. Now, where are the leads? I'm walking in that door. You got 5 seconds to tell me, or you are going to jail. Yeah, I don't care. You understand?
Yeah. Also, I mean, you know, the other reason I chose this movie is because the most creative uses of the word fuck.
I was wondering if you're going to bring that up or not.
Yeah, no, we got it.
The language is colorful.
There is colorful language all over this movie. And I'm sorry. When you hear a good swear, when you hear people who know how to swear, there was nothing like it.
I've been in this business 15 years.
What's your name?
Fuck you. That's my name.
There's nothing like good swearing.
And well, there's a difference between swearing for swearing's sake and swearing with effect.
Are you coming for me on this one?
No.
Are you trying to? No, you're not coming for me? Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
I'm not. I'm not saying that you, maybe sometimes you do, but in works of art, right? In scripts and books and screenplays, it's so easy to throw it out as like when someone's angry, right? To just have them say fuck this and fuck that and all that.
Yes.
To use it effectively though is a whole different story. And this is definitely a situation where that happens. Cause they don't hold back. Alec Baldwin's a pretty, I haven't seen it in a long time, but I remember Alec Baldwin being a pretty almost scary dude.
It's one of the, I mean, I'll read you this and then you bleed into it with the actual performance of it. But there's a scene where Al Pacino's character, you know, his Williamson, who's kind of the office, he's the office manager. He keeps ordering the office. He discerns who gets the leads and who don't. He screws him over. He makes him lose a lead. And Roma turns to him and he says, I'm going to read this. And again, I'm so sorry for all the language. You stupid fucking cunt. Williamson, I'm talking to you, shithead.
You just cost me $6,000. $6,000 and one Cadillac. That's right. What are you going to do about it? What are you going to do about it, asshole? You fucking shit. Where did you learn your trade, you stupid fucking cunt, you idiot? Whoever told you that you could work with men?
Then he goes.
I'll tell you something else. I hope you rip the joint off. I can tell our friend here a little something might help him to catch you. You want to learn the first rule? You'd know if you ever spent a day in your life. You never open your mouth till you know what the shot is. You fucking child.
It's ridiculous.
I love that.
It's so good. And it's like not even like, again, he's not overusing the swears, but it's just like he is placing them so perfectly that you're just watching this man get eviscerated. It's, oh my God, I love it so much. I love it so much. And then Jack Lemmon at the end, like I said, is just, you know, he thinks he's won. And then Kevin Spacey comes back in. And it really just is about this concept of like when you are living in a society that is dog eat dog. And, you know, and there's only one prize. Everybody gets vicious and people lose. Everyone loses. And, you know, he did this. He kind of, you know, American Buffalo, which is his other most famous play, which was turned into a movie that I have a soft spot for, but is not as effective as Glengarry is. Glengarry as a movie is much more effective than American Buffalo. You know, both of these movies are about people trying to con the American dream, trying to like take that gamble and make that sale and steal that thing. And, you know, it really just watching these guys go head to head. I mean, you talk about Meryl Streep versus Philip Seymour Hoffman, Al Pacino versus Kevin Spacey, versus Ed Harris. Do you mean like insane? Insane.
So I mean, both our films, like it. There's definitely it's kind of like a set amount of characters, right? I mean, Glengarry, I'd say a small amount of characters, but it's not
tiny.
It's not small, but it's a defined.
It's
cast,
large,
right?
Large for a play, but it's, I mean, it is
large
small
for a play,
cast.
but small cast, one or two locations, like small locations, with just, which I guess makes sense. Are there examples of really good play translations that are completely different, that open wide up to the world and are not focused on the performance as much? And the
Amadeus is certainly one.
Yep.
Amadeus definitely.
I hadn't even
up.
Realized that Amadeus was a play.
Oh, dude, Amadeus is incredible. They actually just did an amazing production in the West End back in, I think it was like 2017.
Yeah.
With one of my favorite actors, this black man, I forget, Lucius, oh my God, I forget his name. But it was an incredible production, and they had like a live orchestra on stage playing along, and like it was just, I watched it on the YouTube when the West End is putting a lot of their shows on YouTube, and it was gorgeous to see. Also, Angels in America, which is a miniseries. They made it into a miniseries smartly because Angels in America is such a big task for one film. But that piece on stage, definitely spans a lot of time and place. But like a lot of that is supposed to be done minimalistically. Like it's more just like we say we're here and now we're here. Do you know what I mean? As opposed to building the grandiose sets and really placing you in this crazy fantasia, which the movie does excellently. I was going to say One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, but that really just sits in the hospital. So maybe
it does, but for some reason it feels more organic.
Yeah.
The dialogue is not play-like in that.
No, it's not.
Like
maybe
the characters in you know, the setups are a little bit stagey, but it feels very much like you wouldn't know it's based on a play watching.
No,
it, right?
You wouldn't.
It's a good idea for a movie. It's effectively played by all the actors. The world feels real.
I would also say Dangerous Liaisons, and Streetcar Named Desire.
Okay,
those two definitely. I mean, Streetcar certainly feel. I think Streetcar, and maybe because of the era in which it was made, feels like a film.
Yeah.
You know, because it's so many of the films of that era were essentially just like Casablanca, and we talked about this when we recorded the quarantine movie podcast, or the My Wife Has Left Me for Grad School podcast. Casablanca certainly feels like a stage play.
Well, I think a lot of movies of that era do because they had the same confinements, right?
Yeah.
A movie was a filmed play where you build a set. And the cameras weren't going off the set very much until like Hitchcock started to do it.
So
a lot of the early films were, and you get that, like you wonder why do all the actors sound, why do they intone things like this? Like why is this being vocalized like this? Why are they acting? Because it's not natural at all. But if you think about someone performing a movie from the 30s or 40s on a stage, it actually makes sense why everything is kind of rigid and proper and inflected, you know.
Makes a lot of sense.
There's a lot of, yeah.
Makes sense.
One thing I was curious about, I had an original choice that I was going to pick for this, and because I was sure it was based on a play, and then I looked at it and it wasn't. It was based on a teleplay, which is 12 Angry Men.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, you know, 12 people in a room and that's it, talking. The whole thing is just people sitting around talking for the whole time. I was like, that's got to be a play because that's a perfect play. It's not. It was developed for TV and then filmed.
Wow.
It probably went the opposite direction, to be honest. I can't imagine they haven't staged it in one way or another. But 12 Angry Men. According to Wikipedia, it's based on a teleplay.
No, that's incredible. That's really, I would have thought that would absolutely be a play.
Right.
But no, good for them. And that, again, and that's, I think that speaks to kind of the nature that can be, you know, very true is, you know, look, if you have a good idea for 12 guys in a room, you know what I mean? Like if you like,
I'm sure you have a good idea for that.
I love single location. I love, because I love pop.
It's more talking about just having 12 guys in a room. sounds like something you'd be interested in.
You know what? Yeah, man, I would. I would love that. And because I'm a, you know, a man who understands that sexuality is a fluid thing, and you know, we can have, you know, many loves.
I mean, I'm sure that we'd put you in a room with 12 people and you would come out with a play.
I would.
That's what would happen.
That's exactly what would happen. It'd be a great play. It'd be called 12 People Decide to Kill Alex Smalow.
Honestly, I'd see it.
I know you would, man.
I'd see it.
That's because you have an issue. You know what that issue is? You're a masochist.
Yeah.
Gotta work on that, bro. Gotta work on that. Really not okay. Really weird.
You got it. You got it, bro.
You got it, bro. But yeah, so Doubt and Glengarry Glen Ross.
You be as cold as you want. You just fucked a good man out of $6,000 and his goddamn bonus because you didn't know the shot. You can do that, and you're not man enough to say it gets you. I don't know what. If you can't take something from that, then you're scum. You're fucking white bread. A child would know it. He's right. If you're going to make something up, John, be sure that it helps. Hmm? Or keep your mouth shut.
I got to watch Glengarry again.
Yeah, and I got to watch Doubt again.
Glengarry got... Before I'd ever seen it, I had heard about it because of the all-male cast. It has kind of that reputation because on film, it was like a strange thing. There's no female performers in the film.
At all. Although I will say, I am the biggest advocate for an all female production of Glengarry. And my dream, so if my first dream is that I want to play Ricky Roma. My second dream is that I want to watch Ruth Negga play Ricky Roma.
Ooh,
I feel like Ruth Negga
would
destroy it.
Not to mention the other ways you could fill the rest of the cast.
Oh my God. No, I mean, like, I have that cast stat. Are you kidding me? Meryl Streep as Shelley. Ruth Negga as Ricky Roma. I would love to see, let me look at this cast list to make sure I'm getting everybody. You put, if you're going to do the Alec Baldwin, I think that's Tessa Thompson.
Okay.
In a heartbeat. For the Kevin Spacey,
just based on her Westworld character alone,
based on her, like, just her, there's just something where, like, when she talks, people listen, and I think she could kill that. For the Ed Harris character, I mean, you could go a lot of ways with that. I could certainly see, like, a like Cate Blanchett. You need somebody who can really do character. That's what you need for that. That's why my mind went there. I would love to see. I mean, I could see Amy Adams as the Alan Arkin part. I could also see, like, what's her name from Booksmart? Just somebody, like, because I would love to see a young Moss. I would love to see a young Moss and, like, somebody who's not schooled. And that could be great to have, like, a young
actor. Well, speaking of Moss,
Caitlin Dever.
Elizabeth Moss would probably be...
Oh, Elizabeth Moss. Elizabeth Moss would be great
She'd fit right into that whole dynamic, yeah.
Oh, my God. That'd be great. And then, you know, I mean, it would just be a stacked cast, dude. You could really... have some fun with that.
But instead, we get Ocean's 8.
Which I loved.
Did you?
I loved it. I will say, I thought Ocean's 8 was a ton of fun.
Better than Ghostbusters.
Ghostbusters was a misfire.
That was a misfire.
Because this is, you know, again, two cis straight men talking about this movie or these movies. Here's what I will say. I think that when you are doing, if you're going to do an all women reboot, which, like, go for it, do it.
Absolutely.
Be free. I think that you have to really just like any other movie, like, just define your movie. What is the world?
If you're going to do it, if the whole idea is let's, like, gender swap a famous IP. Then you have to have a deeper reason than that. It's not like, okay, we're going to fill it with female characters and then just write a normal comedy as it is. Because no, like, there's the reality that you've done this for a reason. And it has to, like, if you did it with Glengarry Glen Ross, that talks to power dynamic in America, right? That talks to the modern age and change. Literally just making that choice says something about something. Ghostbusters was such a misfire because it's like, well, okay, like, you just did this as, like, almost like a marketing ploy because the movie was written so flat. Like, everything is so...
And it was, well, it was strange, too, because I think the thing that they missed was in, you know, the thing that makes the original Ghostbusters the movie is not about anything. Like, nothing happens. These characters don't change. It's literally just these three dudes and a black guy fighting ghosts.
Right.
But the thing that makes it work is that between Egon, Venkman, and Spangler, they have three distinct personalities and three distinct brands of comedy. And you had brilliant comedians. You had Kristen Wiig. Oh my God, I'm going to kill myself for missing these people's names, because one of them was my camp counselor from
what
2000. Dude, we're gonna get into that in this
episode.
Awkwafina? No, are you? Awkwafina wasn't in. Kristen Wiig, Melissa McCarthy, and Kate McKinnon. Kate McKinnon was my camp counselor at Northwestern. Cherubs in 2008.
Wait, really?
Yeah, man.
Huh.
I she was, and also I will say, because that camp was this ended up being the site of some huge racial injustice, but she was one of, she was like the shining light in that experience. She was awesome. Yeah, she really made my summer. But yeah, you have three incredibly, or four, and Leslie Jones,
yeah.
Four incredibly distinct brands of comedy, and yet it was almost like they all wanted to be the Venkman. Like, it was almost like you wrote them all as the Bill Murray. Like, I'm right. I'm in it, but I don't really care about it. It's like, no, you got to let one of them be the Egon. One of them be like, that's what makes that work. It's like three Stooges, but in ghosts. Do you know what I mean? Right. Like, yeah, I was like, you did these actors a disservice. Be specific. Be specific with your world. And that's just a rule for any good movie. Be specific, you know? So yeah, man, but. You know, I would love to see that version of Glengarry, and I hope that we get to see it. And I honestly
I wouldn't be surprised if
it, I want it. Yeah, please.
It makes a lot of sense.
Makes a huge
amount of sense. Even if only on stage, maybe.
Yeah, on stage, and then maybe a movie after that. But it's like, yeah, Glengarry is definitely a story that we need right now, I think. You know, because it just speaks to the moment. But yeah, Doubt and Glengarry, man. Excellent choices.
Excellent choices. You know, both of them.
Maybe next week we can talk about musicals that I started writing with you that you abandoned me on, and yet still contractually you're going to get paid for.
You never sent me the goddamn contract.
Yeah, I didn't send you a contract.
I don't have a contract, so you could still steal my work, which, like, ripe lawsuit. I'm sure we have emails and texts abound with you confirming that I was the creative, you know, center point.
No, not that you're the creative center
of this show.
That emails and texts that abound that I show that I had to drag you along. You're like, all right, and then you gave up.
Is this what, part two of the Bloody Boston trilogy?
This is, I mean, in the chronology of the Bloody Boston trilogy, this is part three. Well, yeah, part no, it's, I guess it is part two because This Ends Tonight is actually where I'd want it to be. Uncle Jackie, Whiskey Land, This Ends Tonight. That's what I want.
Cool. Well, yeah. As long as I get my royalty check,
I'm not getting shit. You're not getting shit. I'm staring at a poster with your name on it. I'm like, why is his name there? He did not contribute anything.
Yes.
To this fucking show.
It's my life's work to make sure that the 2 weeks of lazy songwriting I did for you becomes pays for my grandchildren to go to college.
I want that for you so bad. So bad. Yeah, man. Incredible. Well, there you go.
Amazing. All right. Get at us. Well, you do this part.
No, yeah. Little Justice Pod on Instagram and Little Justice Pod on Twitter. Get at us. Yeah. Let us know what you
get
think.
Get at us. Let us know if you have episode ideas too, if you want to hear us, if you have guest ideas, if you want to hear someone come on. We know people. So
we do, in fact, know some people. We have some ideas.
Yeah. Let us know. Yeah.
All right, guys.
All right. See you next time.
Bye.
Little justice. Little justice. Little justice. Fuck yeah.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just Ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.